And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3064. And for the record, Representative Bowman is absent, and the rest are going to be coming on in, as they do. I'll have our committee administrator describe House Bill 3064.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 3064 would require the director of DCBS to adopt rules defining ordinary repairs for electrical, plumbing, and the 1- and 2-family dwelling code. And it exempts ordinary repairs from the permit and license requirements for those specific defined repairs.
All right, thank you very much, and we'll call forward Mr. Bill DeFries, please. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Carl Wilson, District 49 State Representative, Grants Pass Cave Junction, Josephine County, Oregon. I am here in the company of Mr. Bill DeFries, a man who I have known for quite some time. And we come to you today explaining the reason for House Bill 3064. I'm going to let Mr. DeFries tell his tale here in just a moment. As we do, though, I implore you to listen closely to his story, and he's going to recite a bit about what has happened to him in his business as a home repair person. It's a rather interesting story. He is going to tell you about a home repair that he did one time for an individual in my area and wound up getting slapped hard by the state for doing so. He's going to explain the reason why that happened and the remedy to that situation as he sees it to be. One contention that Mr. DeFries is going to say today is that individuals like him, the home handymen who do work for individuals, do the kinds of jobs that most contractors would never want to do. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Bill DeFries, and he will give his name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson, gentlemen of the committee. In regards to building House Bill 3064, my name is Bill DeFries. I do business as the Home Ranger in the Grants Pass area. My Oregon license number is 84359. And as you see, I live in Grants Pass. I've been in the building business for over 40 years and a contractor for over 30 years. I've worked and coordinated large and small projects. 7 years ago, I applied for and passed the Oregon tests and received my contractor's registration after moving to Grants Pass. According to the application and instructions given to me by the State Board under the classification that I applied for, general contractor, residential only, and if you'll take a second and look at that last page that you've been handed there, it says that the general contractor, residential only, requires a $10,000 bond, $100,000 liability, and so on. And it says, residential general contractors constructing new homes, doing home remodeling, or working on small non-residential structures belong in this category. General contractors may also do specialty contractor work. If you turn the page over, there's a list of your specialty contractors. That's the English I learned in school, and I understood it that way. I had been told several times that I cannot do any plumbing, and I cannot do any electrical, and I cannot do any of this, and I can't do any of this, and so on. When I applied for renewal of my license, I asked the woman at the counter in Salem, "This question has come up. Would you please be kind enough to show me where this is in writing?" The woman told me that she didn't know where it was in writing, but she was told to tell me that. I asked for her supervisor. I got the same answer. She didn't know where it was in writing. But anyway, during the course of remodeling a customer's bathroom, he remarked how nice it was to have a contractor do the complete job and do it right. He mentioned having a dishwasher delivered and having to hire a plumber to do the hookup and having to hire an electrician to do the electrical hookup for a total of $250. The interesting thing about this is that we, in the state of Oregon, allow the homeowner to do anything he absolutely wants to his home. Plumbing, electrical, framing, whatever. And we all know what that leads to. Yet the experienced contractor, like myself, is handcuffed with this situation. This bathroom remodel I'm referring to. When I gutted the bathroom, where the shower had been in tile and quite destroyed over the years, part of the contract was to install an anti-scald valve in the wall when you had it open. Makes a lot of sense. In my business, I have been known to be able to take and tear a shower completely out, put in this valve, set the new pan, set the wall, the shower door, and leave in the same day, gentlemen. And I can prove that, okay? Because I am able to put this valve in. Put yourself in your own home. The contractor comes in, he tears the shower out. Now he has to wait to get the plumber there to put this valve in and set the pan. One day, 2 days, maybe. Maybe you might get lucky and get him there the same day. But it has been my experience over these many years of being in the business. It is difficult to get a plumber or an electrician to come out for a small job. And when they do, as I state here, the price is sometimes exorbitant because it takes them away from a bigger job. So the consumer is being taken advantage, in some cases, in my opinion, unfairly. If I understand the bill being presented, small contractors are doing these types of repairs or remodeling, have no interest in plumbing or wiring a whole house. I have never wired a whole house. I have never plumbed a whole house. I get calls for people that have had a swimming pool put in. They'd like the window taken out of their master bedroom and put in a sliding glass door. I can do that job in one day because I'm the one that has learned how to move the plug that's usually under that window. If you think about your own homes, I can move that plug. And what am I costing the customer? I'm not costing them an inconvenience of having to wait for that subcontractor to come. We need to be allowed to do a few hundred dollars worth of work related work to repair or remodeling contract. This limited amount would allow the small contractor or repairman to do specialty work, which is no threat to the big contractor, and it immediately helps the consumer get the job done in one fell swoop. The laws and regulations, as I understand them, are allowing the consumer to be taken advantage of many times unfairly. The way the law is currently being interpreted and enforced penalizes both the consumer and the contractor. Your countertop, your Formica countertop people, they are allowed to go in and disconnect the sink and take it all apart and take the counter off the cabinet. They can put the new counter on and they can cut the hole, but they can't hook the sink back up. The customer has to apply another contractor in there to hook the sink back up. And that does not take a rocket scientist to do that. Ceiling fans. I did a job for Ernst. I was installing cabinets at this lady's house for Ernst. Her husband works overseas for 6 months. He's home for a month, and then he goes back overseas. He had another year to go, and she is remodeling the house for their retirement. She said, I live here alone. Could you hang this motion detector out on the front of my house instead of the other light that's there? I said yes, and I did that. I've done it a zillion times. She also asked me to hang a ceiling fan in her living room where an existing fixture was. I climbed into the attic. I reinforced the electrical box and hung the fan for her. After I left her job, she had a swimming pool put in. She said that she invited the electrician in to do some electrical work on the house, and he remarked at how beautiful the kitchen was. And she commenced to tell him who did it. And to be very honest with you, she was bragging about me. This is the only person she can think of that may have said something. 3 weeks later, she said that what brought this about is I received a notice in the mail that I was being fined $1,500 for doing electrical work and plumbing work without being licensed. Again, I refer to that sheet that I signed up under. The woman said that about 3 weeks later, she received a call from a man and a woman at her front door who acted like they were interested in hiring me, and I was referred to them. She was referred to them. She invited them in. She showed them everything I had done. Then they handed her the business card, and they were from the contractor's consumer affairs department. During the course of trying to appeal this situation, the deputy that we were speaking to here in Salem made some rather hostile remarks to myself and to my attorney. One of them being that when we suggested we appeal it, the man made the statement that it's going to cost me more to go through you than it would be to just pay the fine and forget it. I did not think that that was the way a state person should have spoke to us. Through the course of negotiation, we got it down to $500. Because the city said it wasn't required that we have a permit. We had to write to the city, and the city said it wasn't required to have a permit to run an ice maker or to change a fixture on the outside of the house. I thank you very much for listening to me, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I might add just one thing before any questions. Referring back to the bill itself, 3064, it directs the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules defining ordinary repairs for electrical, plumbing, and one- and two-family dwelling codes, exempts ordinary repairs from permit and license requirements.
Any questions?
Thank
you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Gary Wright.
Gentlemen, for your time. Ladies and gentlemen,
and Mr. Chairman. Gary Wright.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Gary Wright, representing myself and UA Local 290 Plumbers and Pipe Fitters. I sometimes feel like this might be a suicide mission in having to come up here and speak against this bill. If my memory serves me correctly, this is a bill that was put in by Representative Repine last session. I believe in about the 1993 session, we did some legislation here for plumbing and I think electrical that defined ordinary repairs. Basically what it said was that there would be no permits required for ordinary repairs if they're done by licensed plumbers and electricians. With all due respect to Mr. DeFries and Representative Wilson, understanding the constituency thing, and Mr. DeFries may be a very reputable contractor, but sometimes that's not really the norm. If any of you watched 2020 just the other night, I think it was Monday night, there was about a 20 or 30 minute segment on just that, remodeling kitchens and putting on decks and how the consumer kind of gets taken advantage of because of the shoddy workmanship that's out there and the needs for licensed folks and inspections and permits on these things. There was a roofs that leaked and plumbing that leaked and houses that were open and decks that weren't installed properly. So I guess with that, I'll just close and have to oppose this bill. We feel that it's necessary to have licensed folks do the plumbing and electrical work.
Representative Starr.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony today. Do you think that you should have to be a licensed electrical contractor to install a ceiling fan in somebody's house?
Mr. Chair, to Representative Starr, I'm not an electrician. I'm the plumber guy. So, I mean, I guess I would, the homeowner can do it. I think if anybody's out there that's contracting and charging the consumer money for a service, whether it be electrical or plumbing, and the rules and statutes require that they be licensed. I think they need to be licensed to do that. There can be other, I mean, it sounds like it's real simple and easy, but just like on the TV the other night on 2020, a simple little, it was a remove the plug, put in a door to go underneath, to go out onto your deck. They spliced the wires and laid them down in a channel and just put wire nets on them. Well, again, I'm not the electrician, but that's quite a fire hazard. The thing was accomplished, the plug was moved, the patio door was installed, but it literally wasn't a very safe installation by just having laid underneath the patio door in a channel.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. John Gervais.
He's not here, too bad.
Is anybody here left to testify on House Bill
3064? He had his chance.
Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3064. And we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3063. Commissioner Jack Robbins, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jack Robbins. I'm the Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. The bill that you have before you makes some amendments to our wage security fund, and I thought it might be helpful if I gave you a little bit of background on this fund, its history, and its operation. The Wage Security Fund was created, I believe it was 1985 session, and the purpose of that fund was to help workers who were left with unpaid wages when a business closed shop and left and disappeared or filed bankruptcy. The rationale was that workers were often not in a very good position to take the time or to have the resources to pursue the collection of those wages, and that it would be nice to have a way to make sure that we kept them whole while we as a state had the opportunity to pursue collection where possible. The funding mechanism for that was a diversion from the unemployment insurance premiums and a one-time or one biennium assessment of 0.03% of the insurance unemployment insurance premiums collected during one quarter of the biennium was used to fund this. And from that fund would be paid unclaimed wages that a person had when a business left or filed bankruptcy up to a maximum of $2,000 and for wages that were paid that were accrued during the 60 days prior to the time the business closed. This was initially authorized on a single biennium basis, and for five biennia it was reauthorized on a trial basis. When I was elected and took office in 1995, we came in and on the basis of a 10-year history asked that it be reauthorized permanently, and that was done. The Wage Security Fund has, I think, an exemplary record of being able to provide assistance to people in need. And while it is true that because these businesses are in bankruptcy or otherwise disappeared, we are often not able to then collect the money, and so there is a net cost to the fund. The fact is that for what is a very, very small diversion of the unemployment insurance fund, we have a protection that is unequaled anywhere in the country. We saw a good example of how well this worked in 1995 when Smith's Home Furnishing went out of business and it became the largest single claim against us. It was almost $500,000. We were able through bankruptcy to collect, I think, over half of that back, but a certain portion remained unclaimed. What was interesting was to compare the treatment of Oregon employees of that company with those in Idaho and Washington where they don't have a comparable fund. There, the employees were left with nothing initially and then ultimately collected only a part of their payments. And in Oregon, we were able to collect for everyone, we were able to pay for everyone up to $2,000. The reason the $2,000 limit or maximum was initially adopted was because at that time, that was the maximum preference in bankruptcy for a wage claim. A person was owed up to $2,000, received preferential payment before other creditors. Anything beyond $2,000 would go in with the other creditors. And so that was adopted as the maximum. What we're proposing today are two changes that we think would make the fund work better. One, in 1994, the bankruptcy code was changed to allow a preference of up to $4,000 for wage claims. We believe that our act should be adjusted similarly so that people who have wage claims up to $4,000 will be paid out of this fund, and we will then take their place and have their preference in bankruptcy court. And this would result in about a 9% increase in the payout from our fund. We currently have a $2 million balance in that fund. It would not in any way, so the additional amount would be about $118,000 that we would pay out. The fund is very healthy. It could accommodate that as consistent with the intent of the original statute, and therefore think it would be appropriate. The second change is one that would come up far less often, but, and it was what was brought to our attention by Representative Wilson. And the specific case involved a worker who was not being paid by an employer and who, because he wasn't being paid, quit and filed a claim with our office. We then were processing the claim and trying to determine the validity of the claim, collect the claim, do our normal processing. And while we were doing that and made demand for payment and were in the process of pursuing this, the company went out of business. Those people who were then employed by the employer and who had accrued wages in the last 60 days were entitled to payment out of the Wage Security Fund. Because this claim had been filed for wages more than 60 days before that date, this claimant, under the strict interpretation of our statute, would not have been entitled to collect. We felt that was an unjust result. We don't believe that employees who are not being paid and who are pursuing collection ought to be treated differently than those who continue working and are not being paid. And we looked at our rules and tried to figure out whether we could reinterpret the provision for payment within the last 60 days to also include wage claims that were valid and were found. We thought that that's a one reasonable interpretation that one could make. And in that, in the case involved, we were able to make that determination. But we wanted to come to this body and ask for a clarification in the statute that would make it clear that the amount that would be accruing would be people who had worked for 60 days before that time, or people who had wage claims that were unsatisfied, representing up to 60 days worth of work during the 60-day period before the company went out of business. In reviewing our files, we believe this comes up very, very rarely. But in those situations where it does, we believe that it would be unjust to deny those people their recovery. The fiscal impact on that would be negligible. We think it makes the fund work better. We think this is a successful fund and is an example of having a system where we protect people who are otherwise left with in a difficult situation without an undue strain on the employers and on the businesses. And so for that reason, we think this would help strengthen a fund that's already a success and would urge you to pass it.
Any questions?
For the record, Carl Wilson, District 49, State Representative, Josephine County, Oregon. I really have nothing to add in addition to Commissioner Roberts' comments. This particular case came up in my area when some long-haul truckers who are working for a company hit the rocks when the company started going out of business. They couldn't pay them any further. And so this was brought to my attention by these constituents who, for the aforementioned reasons, were unable to take advantage of this fund. Bottom line is they were able to be taken care of thanks to a little expert work here from Commissioner Roberts, and we were able to do that, and that I appreciate. But really, to clarify things, we need to put this in statute. And it's a great plan. It really is. It is something that can really make the difference in the lives of individuals. And appreciate your support of it.
Thank you. Eric Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric Fletcher, Oregon, AFL-CIO. I won't read what you can read. That's a brief history of this, but it was created due to a plant closure in southern Oregon in the summer of 1984, when about 200 sawmill workers found themselves out of work due to a bankrupt company, marched on the headquarters of the bank in Portland and found out the bank has first claim on the assets during bankruptcy, so there was no way to pay these people. Frank Bronner, who was a good bill, is, thank you, Representative Harper, and I'll be very short. Frank Bronner, who represented the bankers, said this is something we need to take care of. and with the sponsorship of the Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Bureau of Labor, Mary Winnie Roberts. This fund was created but kept on short rations for many years now. It's a permanent fund, and I really commend Representative Wilson for bringing this to us for a wage increase, which is long overdue, and for closing a loophole for people who may have been caught short. So I would commend you, Representative Wilson, for bringing this bill, and it's a good pro-worker bill and ought to pass.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3063? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3063, and we'll open the work session, or will we move to 2891?
Work session.
And we'll move to a work session on House Bill 2891.
Let's find our sign-up sheet here. Oh, okay. All right, very good.
Is there any?
All right. In 2891,
do you have any problem?
As you recall, we've visited this before. CESA's obligation of successful bidder on public improvement contract to provide bond or check upon completion of that project. We had a public hearing on this before. I don't think we quite gripped the issue. We would like to bring some folks up today to fill us in as we work on this. And I'd like to call David Dothwaite, please, Drake Construction AGC member.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Dothwaite. I am with Drake Construction, a large building contractor in the Portland area, and an active member of the Public Contracting Coalition. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2891, which clarifies how a performance bond applies to the design aspect on a design-build public improvement project. Public improvement construction project generally involves two different functions. First, designing the improvement, and second, building it. Traditionally, owners hire an architect or an engineer to design a public improvement and then hire a contractor to build it. The owner looks to the designer to make sure that the design is adequate and correct, and sometimes requires that designer to protect the owner by having errors and omissions insurance to cover the cost of any design errors. However, the statutes do not require that the designers post what's called a performance bond to guarantee that they complete their work. Design build, as it's called, combines those two functions. The owner hires a design builder who both designs the public improvement project and constructs it. House Bill 2891 has two parts. First, it clarifies that the performance bond on a design build project for a public improvement will ensure the faithful completion and delivery of the design work and related services, as well as ensure that the construction work is completed. House Bill 2891 requires the design builder to keep his performance bond in place until the project is finally completed or for any additional time required in the contract. However, this bill makes it clear that the performance bond does not cover design errors. The owner can still protect itself from errors in the design by requiring the design builder to get errors and omissions insurance, as the owner does now. I'd be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee may have.
Thank you. Do we have questions? All right. Thanks very much. I think all of you are in possession of the dash fours. And is there anyone like to describe the dash fours to us? Anyone out there? David, as long as you're still here, why don't I have you do that, if you would, please? You would explain those for us before we get.
The Dash 4 amendments are not really as extensive as they appear. Let me tell you the context of how they came about so you understand why there's so many words. This is a consensus bill from the Public Contracting Coalition, as you heard at the first hearing, that includes a number of public owners, both large and small, private contractors, labor, and other interested parties. getting a group like that to come to a consensus takes some time. When it came time to get a bill drafted, I made an initial attempt to draft, and that's what's in the bill. After the various groups came together and worked to come up to a consensus, you see the language that is the Dash 4 amendments that essentially reflects the consensus of that group. It has been a period of some months of negotiation and work with the various stakeholders to come up with this consensus language. What this language in Dash 4 amendments does is it makes it clear that the performance bond on a design-build project guarantees the completion and delivery of the design. Now, you don't have that under a traditional design-bid-build project. The performance bond covers only the construction aspect of the project, and you don't have a performance bond guaranteeing the design aspect. So this makes it clear that the contractor's performance bond does include the completion and delivery of that design. But it also makes it clear that once the project is completed, the surety bond does not have any leftover liability for errors in that design. Some errors in design may not be discovered for many years after the project is completed. The owner can request the design builder to provide errors and omissions insurance to cover that. The language in this amendment makes clear, in the opinion of all the stakeholders, that the surety bond is not responsible for design errors.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
Actually, I don't have a question. I have a motion.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2891.
Representative Starr moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2891. Is there a discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Goldman. Deckard.
Yes.
Harper.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Sunseri.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Wilson.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I would move House Bill 2891 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves House Bill 2891 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk.
Atkinson.
Yes.
Beck.
Yes.
Bowman. Deckard?
Yeah.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Starr, would you carry that for us, please?
Certainly.
Thank you. I'd like to go back and open a work session on House Bill 3063. I'm sorry in the confusion a moment ago on the transition here. I forgot to go into that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Deckard.
Move House Bill 3063 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Deckard moves House Bill 3063 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I'm seeing none. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson.
Yes.
Beck.
Yes.
Bowman. Deckard.
Yes.
Harper.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Sunseri.
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Yes. House Bill 3063 is adopted, and Representative Deckard, would you carry that for us, please? All right, thank you very much.
Pardon me?
Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 2890. Get our paperwork together here for just a moment. I'd like to call up Cindy Cato, AGC, please.
Good afternoon. I apologize for my voice. It's going to float in and out here.
Thank you. We'll try not to work you too hard. I appreciate you being here. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of issues in particular today on this bill. One of the issues on this bill that has been raised has been that this bill would, first of all, be costly for those subcontractors who are being required to file notice. and that it would cause a virtual paper blizzard coming your direction. And I know in the previous AGC testimony you have testified to the fact that this bill is necessary for you to know who is actually on the job. I guess a presumption that we could make here as a committee is that if anybody is sensitive about being snowed by paperwork, it might be you in this particular case. Would you address that aspect?
Certainly. Actually, this is for all public contracts, and in the private side, right now under ORS 87, there is a requirement that on residential contracts, all parties supply the notice of lien to the owner. The owner then gives it to the general. And on commercial, the material folks have to supply the notice of right to lien, and it comes to the general. So in some instances, we're already getting the paper. What we've tried to do on the public side is level the playing field. And we believe, based upon what our members who are now already supplying notices in the residential area and as material suppliers, that there's a very good system available right now that makes it easy and inexpensive. And it's one that general contractors are already used to seeing. We get the paper, we get it in the file, and then we have the paper trail that we need to make sure that everybody gets paid down the line.
Would you go back and describe for us again something that you alluded to in your previous testimony, that in many cases generals hire individuals who, and I forget the term that was used exactly, to keep on this process to see who is actually out there. How would that system that's currently in place mesh with this law if it were to pass?
That was Mr. Anderson from Anderson Construction who testified to that. And they, in fact, have people on staff who their responsibility is to try to track down these various tiers below the first tier subcontractor. And so what we would expect would happen is that those folks would either not have to exist on the overhead of the general contractor, or what would happen would be that a clerk at a much lesser level would be able to take in these notices, match them up to the appropriate project, and make sure that the project superintendent has all the paperwork that he needs.
Okay, any of you have any questions?
Chair?
Representative Beck.
See, Mr. Roberts here, wondering if this is sort of issue, I don't have him in our committee very often, I'm wondering if this sort of issue he has any thoughts about. Not to put him on the spot, but fair to see him in our gracing our committee. It's a complicated issue.
Yeah. I plan on calling him here.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes, I do. Any further questions? Thank you. We'll dismiss you for right now and probably bring you back here in just a minute.
Okay.
Sorry, you had questions of our witness.
Yes, that's true.
I was getting ahead of things.
Commissioner Roberts, while you're here, and I know you're undoubtedly on a schedule here, we'll tap you while you are here.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I feel like this is one of those situations where you see a fight and you're trying to avoid it, and everyone keeps trying to drag you into it. when we first saw this bill, we were concerned that it would adversely impact the right of workers and of our rights to enforce wage claims. So we went to AGC and said, did you really mean this to apply to wage claims? They said, no, that's really not what we were talking about. And we said, would you be willing to amend this to take us out? And they said yes, and the Dash 1 amendments, which you have, accomplishes that. So it takes out the wage claims. And based on that, we don't have a dog in this fight, really. This is not our issue. And how the contracting laws, which we do not enforce, and how it affects other people who have claims is really aside the point from our standpoint. And so while we're not here supporting the bill and encouraging you and don't necessarily feel that there's a particular reason for it, we do believe that if it affected wage claims, we would have a very strong opposition to it. And since that has been addressed, we
and withdrawn our opposition.
All right, thank you. Any further questions? All right, thank you. Okay, very good. Let's go ahead and call Paul Phillips. Paul, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I'm representing today the Oregon Equipment Rental Association, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Oregon State Building Trades, IBEW specifically, Plumbers UA 290 specifically, and Sheet Metal and Floor Covering Contractors. I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your allowing me to bring with me two individuals, Norm Malvin and Tom Murphy, both who are attorneys. Tom represents, is from the law firm of Fur and Scott and represents the Oregon Criminal Rental Association. And Norman is from IBEW, previously was in private practice on these types of claims, in addition was a Boley employee. We called the lobbyists for AGC yesterday, and they did fax us last evening the amendments, so our comments will be addressed towards the amendments that they have proposed. The questions still exist. I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your desire to deal with what you described as a pay-twice issue. But I would raise the question, and I believe Mr. Malvin and Mr. Murphy will identify whether this is the way to address that. Does the problem exist, and is this the answer to it? And I appreciate that certain contracts want to limit their liability and want to control their costs. From their perspective, that makes sense. However, is this good from a public policy standpoint, from a consumer, from a market standpoint, from an industry standpoint? The commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry said that he no longer opposes the bill if wage claims are out of it. I think Mr. Malvin will address it articulately and point out that wage claims still, in fact, are an issue in this bill. I also appreciate the fact that the representative of the AGC said before you that they felt that there was not a paperwork issue because the generals have this system underway and cited residential liens. However, as Mr. Murphy will address, this is an entirely different issue. And while they speak for their interests, our interests have really raised the issue. In the last decade, since this issue was addressed in any amount, how many bond claims have there been out there that have been a problem? There has been no testimony talking about the scope of this problem. How many pay-twice issues have arisen because of this, and how many pay-twice issues are actually at the fault of the general not following the procedure and keeping track of their job sites? How many construction projects have occurred in the last decade or the last year where there has been a problem? In comparison, is this 1%? Is this a tenth of a percent? When I asked the AGC lobbyist at 12:45 yesterday afternoon as to what is the scope of the problem, I couldn't get an answer. I'd encourage you to ask and find out what's the specific scope of this problem that we're trying to address. I appreciate also that because of other bills that we have put forth, the AGC is sponsoring or at least soliciting input from their members, of which some of them I represent, with regard to payment-related issues. I'd like to see from the scope of their contract how big of an issue this is. Thus far in the testimony, you've heard from two individuals raising an issue. When it occurred within the last decade, who's responsible, what the scope was, versus the costs that will be raised by passage of this bill, are issues that we would like you to examine as you move forward and discuss this pay-twice issue. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Malvin and appreciate your courtesy in letting the three of us testify today on this measure.
Chair represents, my name is Norman Malvin. I'm an attorney. I am no longer in private practice. I'm general counsel to IBEW Local 48. Prior to that, I was in private practice, and I did a lot of wage claims, including bond claims on public works contracts. I did have prepared testimony that were prior to the -1 amendments, which I will now skip over. You've got a technical bill and a technical area of law that you're going to make more technical. I will note that when Representative Wilson asked Ms. Cato about whether or not this would make it more costly for the contractors, her basic response was, we're already set up for it, it's in place now. That may be true for the contractors, but you've got over 2,300 contracting agencies throughout the state of Oregon that are not set up for it and that will now be receiving these notices. They will now need to keep track of it, and they will be scratching their heads wondering what they're supposed to be doing with it. Secondly, and I feel like repeating that for Representative Wilson's benefit, Representative Wilson, did you hear that?
Oh, go ahead.
When Ms. Cato was up here, you asked her whether there's a potential issue of a blizzard of paperwork for the contractors that might be created by this bill, and the basic response that you got was no, because of the lien laws, the contractors are already set up for this, they have people in place, and this is something that they're used to, and that is true by and large. But there are over 2,300 public contracting agencies in the state that are not geared up for it, who are also recipients of, recipients of these notices of right to give bond claims. They would have to figure out who's going to do the work, where to keep it, and what to do with it. So just a side comment. The general contractors exert influence on subcontractors. I had occasion on a wage claim where a subcontractor did not pay wages. The day I filed the bond claim, the general contractor called the sub, and with its influence, the wages were suddenly and magically paid. And the reason is that the bond company tenders the defense to the general contractor, so it's the general contractor who's footing the bill for the defense. So keeping them in the loop of liability serves the public interest well. With the Dash 1 amendments, Commissioner Roberts stated that it won't affect wage claims, and I respectfully disagree. It does purport to exempt wages and penalties due employees, and I predict that that exemption will create certain litigation. One type of litigation is whether the worker who is owed the wages is an employee or is an independent contractor. That is the kind of problem we've seen repeatedly on public works projects, and this would be an additional avenue for a subcontractor to say, I hired this individual as an independent contractor, not as an employee, therefore they had the obligation to file a notice of right to file a bond claim because they were not an employee. Exemption is under the Dash 1 amendment is for wages. As I'm sure you're aware, ORS 279.334 allows for claims for unpaid overtime to be made on a public works bond. Are unpaid overtime the same as unpaid wages? An argument would be made that the legislators know what they say what they mean. They know how to use the words overtime. They know how to use the word wages. You only use the word wages. Therefore, anybody who has a claim for unpaid overtime has the obligation to give a notice of right to make a claim. And if we're going to fall back into that, then I got a whole bunch of problems with the notice of right to file a claim for wage claimants. The Dash 1 amendments also use the language that it would exempt penalties. To people who litigate in this area, there is a distinction between liquidated damages, which are compensatory in nature, and civil penalties, which are punitive in nature. It seems to me that the principal goal of this legislation is to reduce the liability of general contractors. It creates an additional layer of paperwork to do it. That's not good government. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Tom Murphy. I'm an attorney with the firm of Furr and Scott in Tigard, Oregon. I'm also a registered lobbyist on behalf of the Oregon Equipment Rental Association.
The Oregon Equipment Rental Association does oppose House Bill 2890. The Oregon Little Miller Act is modeled upon the federal Miller Act, which and the two statutory schemes have the same purpose. That is to provide security, an alternate source of payment to those who, by contributing their labor, materials, and equipment in furtherance of a public construction project, can get paid for that contribution. The need for a Miller Act on federal or Little Miller Act bond on state, the reason for the bond is that, of course, there can be no lien rights as to public property. The effect of House Bill 2890 inevitably would be to reduce that protection. It shifts the risk of payment or non-payment from the general contractor and its surety to the subcontractors and the vendors. Specifically, it would provide a technical defense for the benefit of the general contractors and their surety insurance companies. That is, that the correct notice was not given, that it was not given in a timely fashion, that it was not given to the correct people. That this is a technical rather than a substantive defense is illustrated by the fact that there is no actual notice exception in House Bill 2890. For instance, if a general contractor knows good and well that a particular second-tier subcontractor or material supplier or equipment rental outfit is contributing to a particular project, knows that very well, but also knows that that particular vendor did not bother or overlooked sending the notice or there is a technical defense in the notice, under House Bill 2890, the general contractor and its surety insurance company would have no liability. Now, I don't want to repeat points that have already been made and ably made. There are two points that I wish to bring to your attention. First of all, what is the general contractor on a public project supposed to do with the notice that it would receive under 2890? The answer is absolutely nothing. Presumably, the general contractor can do something. But does House Bill 2890 require the general contractor to do anything with that notice? For instance, does it require or obligate the general contractor to see to it that the supplier or vendor who provided that notice is paid? The answer is no. Second point, the proponents of House Bill 2890, as I understand it, complain that they do not have the means of knowing who is contributing to their project. Aside from the realities of that, aside from the fact that most equipment or rental vendors put the name of their company rather prominently upon their equipment, the lack of knowledge argument cuts both ways. How is a claimant who is going to be affected by House Bill 2890 to know who is the general contractor on a particular public project? There is no readily available source to find out who is the general contractor for a particular project. This is contrary to the construction lien law, to which the Little Miller Act is frequently analogized, where all that is required is to go to the real property records. The notice of right to a lien has to go to the owner of the property. There is an available public source, the real property records, to find out who is the owner. There is no comparable source to find out who is the general contractor on a given public project. Now, it may well be suggested that Oregon does have an excellent public records law, and that public records can be requested. The difficulty there is the time lag. House Bill 2890 would require that notice of right to make a bond claim be given within 8 business days after the vendor first starts providing on a project, or at least the protection would be retroactive, only 8 business days. Is there any assurance that the necessary information can be requested and obtained from the public body via a public records request within that same period of time? Otherwise, you have the risk of the vendor, who would otherwise be entitled to pursue a Little Miller Act claim, going bare. And this would be especially acute on the more sophisticated modern construction projects where there can be more than one prime contractor, where the response to the question to the public body, who is the general contractor for such and such a multi-million dollar long-term project? And the answer is likely to be another question, which general contractor? For these reasons and for those previously cited, the Oregon Equipment Rental Association does oppose House Bill 2890. And I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that this 2890 wouldn't require the general to do anything with the notice. But don't you believe that if the general contractor had the information in their possession, that then they would have the information to follow through when they paid, to make sure that the payments followed through the different tiers, thus protecting themselves?
Yes, you're correct, Representative Starr. They would have, as you say, the opportunity to protect themselves. However, the statute or the bill as proposed is not balanced in terms of requiring the general contractor to do anything or to provide any additional protection to those whose overall protection under the statute would be reduced.
And Mr. Chair, I would submit that the general contractor is the one that has something to lose here.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to call up Larry Sitz and Syndicato once again from AGC. Thank you. Welcome back. I have been wanting to get around to this question, and now seems to be the appropriate time. And, you know, you well know what's involved in this process of creating legislation. And sometimes it takes a lot of time. You know, we've invested a lot of time in this. And I guess the question that perhaps we should have asked a long time ago, but we just simply assumed, and that was how necessary is this really? The assertion has been made that double pay is something that is not a problem, at least from an occurrence standpoint. Doesn't happen often, and we've been told that we might be doing a whole lot for no real reason. Would you comment on that?
I'll comment in general, and then I would like Mr. Sitz to comment more specifically. In general, we hear that this is a big problem. You heard from two contractors at the last hearing. In the essence of time, I didn't haul in 8 or 10 or 12 contractors. We are testifying on a similar bill for changing the lien law upstairs, and I had 8 contractors there today to testify to a very similar type of change in the private side. So it's a big problem, and when it occurs, it's not a $2,000 problem. It's a $20,000 or a $50,000 or a $100,000 problem. So in general, I hear from my general contractors that it's a problem and it needs to be fixed. With that, I would turn it over to Mr. Sitz to be more specific.
And I don't really have the statistics to talk about the industry-wide issues, but I can speak of our own company. When times are good, the problem is not very big in our industry. The subs are doing well. They're not going broke. And this only is a problem when a sub goes broke. Right now, in the state of Oregon, we've just come out of a construction boom. That boom fueled an expansion of capacity in the construction industry in Oregon. We moved up to meet the boom that we're turning down. We've got more capacity than work in the marketplace, and so we anticipate for the next few years there's going to be a pretty heavy shakeout in the construction-related businesses in the state of Oregon, i.e. more subs are going to be going broke than normal. In a good year, we may have 0 or 1 sub in a given course of the whole year's business that goes broke. In a bad year, we might have 5 or 6. Right now, we're anticipating we're heading into the cycle where it's 5 or 6. That number is a fairly big range, but it's very related to the economy. At the same time, the amount of money that's involved is a pretty big range, and it ranges from like $100 or $1,000 up to $150,000. But our average has been about $25,000 in occurrence. And on a 10-year average, it costs us $50,000 to $75,000 a year. And that's a pretty healthy chunk of change. It's a big chunk of our profits as a business that's going into this problem. And if we had notice, so that we could make sure that we weren't paying for the same work twice, it's not to the same people twice, but for the same work twice, once to the sub who spend it in the wrong place, and once again to the people that actually did the work who deserve to be paid. All we're trying to do is stop that, and we think it's a pretty simple solution.
Thank you. Would you comment on the Dash 2s, first of all?
The Dash 2 amendments are the result of testimony in the hearing. There was a person who testified as to the confusion of whether or not first-tier subcontractors would be required to give notice. When we went back and looked at the way that the original bill was drafted, we saw that it was confusing. That was never our intent. And so what we've done is had Dash 2 amendments drafted that clearly delineate that the first-tier subs do not need to provide notice. The reason they don't need to provide notice is the general knows they exist. We're only trying to catch up on those folks that we don't know exist.
And thank you. Your comments on the Dash 1s?
Dash 1s were simply as a result of the discussion with Foley, and those Dash 1 amendments have been incorporated into the Dash 2 amendment. It's just been reordered, but it's everything's there.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Beck, please.
I just want to kind of follow up on Mr. Phillips. He raised a couple of good questions. This is a complicated issue for those of us who aren't involved in this kind of business, but in terms of the need and this double pay issue, do we have any sense of how often this problem has arisen in, say, the last 10 years or so?
Well,
must keep records.
Yeah.
Someone must contact you guys.
Chair Wilson, Representative Beck, we don't have records at AGC. What I have is contractors like Mr. Sitz, who says over the last 10 years it's averaged $25,000 a year. Mr. Douthwaite in the audience just told me over the last 3 years they've had a claim a year, and they've been in the $50,000 to $100,000 range. You know, this is something that occurs on a regular basis, and I think the thing that we have to continually remind ourselves is the last 5 years have been very good years here in Oregon for the construction industry. The next 5 years aren't supposed to be as good. So if we're having this kind of experience in the last 5 years in good times and things are starting to slow down, we can only expect that it'll get worse. And all we want is to make sure that folks get paid and that we don't pay twice. That's all we're asking.
Chair,
go ahead.
Different question.
Mm-hmm.
The 8-day mm-hmm. notice, help me understand this. So if someone comes to me and says, we want to rent your Caterpillar to come to some site somewhere, and they have 8 days upon which to issue notice to the general contractor that, hey, we're providing a cat, we want to get paid.
That is correct, Representative Beck. And I think
this could be a project that's going on for 2 years. It could be a long, big construction project.
And they only have to provide the notice once. So they may be in and out of the project,
mm-hmm.
but if they are on the project the first time they provide anything to that project, then within 8 days they need to provide notice to the general contractor. And that's an important distinction, because earlier testimonies talked about all these notices going to public agencies.
Mm-hmm.
That's not required by this bill. The only person that's required by this bill to be notified is the general. Now, if the person providing the notice wants to send it to the public agency, that's okay, but we're not requiring that. And we think, since the equipment operators and these multiple tiers can find us when they want to put in a bond claim, there must be some way to find us. So we think it's logical that before they rent a piece of equipment, they ask that person who's coming, who's the general contractor on your project? And what's their address? And when they get that information at the counter and they put it on the rental agreement, then all they'll have to do is send that very simple notice to the general, and everything's covered.
Chair.
Go ahead.
Just why 8 days? Why not 30 days? Again, as someone who's not involved in this
Eight days is made consistent with ORS 87, which is the lien law bill for the private side. That's the requirement there. And so what we're trying to do is make everything consistent so we don't have a lot of different rules between public and private, between residential and commercial, all of those things. So we're just trying to seek consistency here so that it's not confusing.
And what I see the bills in Section 2 is amending, removing the 120-day, what was that 120-day requirement for under 79.528?
The requirement there is just is moved down. The requirement used to be that they would only provide notice up to 120 days after they've done work. We've just moved it and recaptured it down below.
Oh, gotcha. I see that. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot your name.
Cindy.
Do you know if other states around us have similar notification statutes for public projects?
Public projects. I don't know that. Perhaps Mr. Sitzen.
And I don't know the answer to that. It's pretty easy to get to, but I don't have it in my pocket, and so I don't want to speculate.
If anyone did, that'd be great.
Right. Further, Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about some of the testimony that the attorneys talked about earlier when they talked about the Dash 1 amendments where we're exempting wages to employees, penalties. Question was brought up about employees versus independent contractors, whether unpaid overtime would be included, other information about something else, like penalties, liquidated damages. Can you just comment on those things and whether this whether that covers those concerns? Apparently, the Labor Commissioner believes that they do. If we need to be more specific, explicit in the amendments, can you just comment on that?
excuse me, Chair Wilson, Representative Scott. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give you a legal opinion. I can only tell you that we proposed these amendments to make sure that Boley was comfortable. If Boley's not comfortable that overtime is covered, we will amend it again. It's not our intent to cheat an employee out of being paid anything that is due the employee. That's not our intent here. So if Commissioner Roberts is uncomfortable with this verbiage and he believes that we need to amend it to include overtime, we'll certainly do that. You'd need to ask him about that. With regard to the independent contractor versus the employee issue, they need to declare they're either an independent contractor or they're an employee. If they're an independent contractor, they become part of these lower tiers, and they would have to provide notice when they come on the job. If they're an employee, they're covered by the amendments as an employee. So here again, we're not trying to deny anybody payment. We just, if they're a contractor, independent contractor, at these lower tiers, we want to know they exist, and we'll make sure that they get paid. If they're an employee, they can go to their employer, or they can still use their normal route of putting a claim against the bond to get paid.
Any further? All right.
There was one point that was brought up by the equipment dealers that it's pretty easy for us to tell by looking at the equipment that they have equipment on the site, and that is a true statement. The issue that we have is we don't know who that equipment's been rented to, and we don't have a direct linkage to that equipment. We have linkage to the people that they rented it to. And so all we're trying to figure out is which one they rented it to. And for most of the big equipment dealers, it's not uncommon for us to have 10 pieces of equipment from the same company with 6 different subcontractors renting those pieces of equipment.
Thank you. Committee, any further questions on these two? All right. Thank you very much. I believe we'll have I'm going to have John Gervais come up and just talk to us for just a moment on this.
Chair, we were upstairs in the committee.
same kind of concept and didn't have an opportunity.
Okay, I'd like to have a very brief. We need to move on, please.
Yeah. I'm just going to make two comments, and then I'll let them make very brief comments. For the record, my name is John Gervais, representing Construction Industry Committee, about 2,000 small businesses in the state of Oregon. Adamantly opposed this bill. The amendments did make some improvements, I would say. I don't think, and our attorneys don't think, that wages are adequately defined. For instance, fringes and health and welfare payments go beyond the hourly pay and the overtime pay. Does this also include, we have a situation in Portland where we're down $400,000 just on fringes and health and welfare. And I think there's some work to be done on that. Again, the Construction Contractors Board has told me that there were 60 cases of pay twice in the last year out of hundreds of thousands of contracts and 43,000 contractors, and I think this would be an over-response to a situation that could have tighter supervision take care of it than to legislate a situation that is going to cost $20 per contractor per job to send a notice out. And in many parts of the state, there are not situations like BMDA that provide a service that is very trustworthy and very effective.
Chair Wilson and committee members, I'm Pat Jones, and I'm with Consolidated Supply Company. Also, I'm here on behalf of the 1,150 members of the National Association of Credit Management. And I'm worried about this being able to comply with this 8-day notice requirement that's put into the bill. The services that we use, our major service that we use, cannot obtain lien notice service in Umatilla County and some of the other counties in the state. So I don't know how we will be able to notice those counties. One other point is that the general contractors, in their contract, usually withhold a 10% retainage from all their subs in order to cover problems like this. And in my 15 years experience, I've only encountered a couple of pay twice situations. We usually, as credit managers, get to the problem early and try to get it resolved before that situation arises. Thank you very much.
That's a question.
Representative Starr.
Thank you. The 8-day notice, when a subcontractor comes in to rent a piece of machinery or to get supplies from your company,
yes.
At that point of contact, it would not be possible for your company to ask the person ordering the material, where's this going, who's the general contractor on this job, and obtain the information at that point?
Chair Wilson and Representative Starr, yes, in some occasions it is possible. But many occasions, the contractors and subcontractors have runners that are just saying, go to this supplier, pick up this. And they don't know what job it is. We do, on major public works projects, we do try to set up accounts and monitor those just so we can react in time.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chair, I'm a contractor in my other life. I don't do major jobs. I'm a residential contractor, and I have accounts with primarily roofing and residential construction. And I know that when I order materials, I mean, they ask you the job address. I mean, they don't just, and if I send an employee to go pick it up, they, you know, the opportunity is there. They don't just say, you know, give the material to this guy and let him run without any idea of where that material is going. They know that they got to protect their risk in that way. What would you like to comment on that?
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr. I think that you're right that suppliers would have the opportunity to inquire about who's ever ordering or comes in to pick up the material as to where it's going, and as I said, many times that does occur. Many times it does not, and many times whoever picks it up doesn't know, as I said, where they're going. So it's kind of a mixed bag in that respect.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Committee, Jerry Van Scoy with the Associated Floor Covering Contractors. To the question regarding frequency, I would just relate it to the shortfall that we call it with the Construction Contractors Board. I think the last fiscal year, the shortfall, that is the homeowner shortfall that wasn't covered by the bond, that was like $1.7 million. The reason I raise this point is that, you know, that's none of us wants to lose money when we do our remodeling or building a house or anything. We don't want to come up short. But when you look at $1.7 million out of probably in excess of a $1 billion industry, it's a very, very small amount. So like I said before, we don't wish that the general contractors lose anything. But from what I've heard, and not just this session, but in past sessions about this problem, there just isn't, when we look at frequency, you know, of the problem and then look at the requirements of sending literally thousands, and we're not just talking a new building. Every school, city, county, and political subdivision, every time that they do any kind of a job, that somebody's going to have to be sending these notices out. So the frequency of the notices is astronomical. I think the frequency of the problem, from what I've heard, is kind of like the shortfall with the CCB. It's pretty small. Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thanks very much. All right, that'll conclude the testimony here today. And committee, any intentions about the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
I'd move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2890.
Representative Starr moves the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2890. Any discussion? Clerk?
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman? Deckert?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye. Dash 2 amendments are carried. All right, take another motion.
Go ahead, Jason.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2890 as amended to the floor with a due path recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves House Bill 2890 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
This is one of those bills that enters that great gray area, which we occasionally find ourselves in. I'm not sure the case has been made in my mind that we need this. It may be a bit of overkill, although I do hear what the contractors are saying, and I see the other side of it as well. I'm going to vote no now. I'm just not quite there yet, but I'm going to keep open on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk?
Atkinson?
Aye.
I know your case.
Beck?
No.
Bowman? Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And carrier on that, Representative Atkinson, would you try to do that? Representative Atkinson will do that for us. Thank you. All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2890. And we are going to pull House Bill 2964 from the schedule today. We will reschedule that for another time.
I think you're right on that one.
I'm not going to do that.
Great.
You liked it. Well, no, and you don't have to put up with that.
Right.
Yeah. That's scary, that stuff. You vote no.
All right, at this point, for those who are here, we're going to be doing a series of public hearings here. These are simply gavel taps, and so don't get excited. Feel free to go do something else. Thank you.
Thank you.
You don't need it?
Yeah.
Don't need you.
Ah, wonderful.
Okay, we will.
You might have something to say about a few of these, though, they're here.
Okay. All right.
We'll open a public hearing on HJR 28, and we will close the public hearing on HJR 28. Opening the public hearing on HJR 36. Closing the public hearing on HJR 36. We will open a public hearing on HJR 51. We close the public hearing on HJR 51.
Can I reserve my comments on these?
Yes, you certainly can. Please do. Opening a public hearing on HJR 73. Closing the public hearing on HJR 73. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2141. We close the public hearing on House Bill 2141. Opening a public hearing on 2143. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2143. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2364. Closing public hearing on House Bill 2364. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2404. Closing the public hearing on 2404. Opening a public hearing on 2561. And closing public hearing on 2561. Page 3. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2673. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2673. Opening House Bill on 2724, closing public hearing on House Bill 2724. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2725, closing the public hearing on House Bill 2725. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2814, closing the public hearing on House Bill 2814. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2883, closing public hearing on 2883. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2887. Closing public hearing on House Bill 2887. My goodness. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2888. Closing a public hearing on House Bill 2888. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2894. Closing a public hearing on 2894. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2970. Closing public hearing on House Bill 2970. Opening a House Bill on opening a public hearing on House Bill 2971 and closing a public hearing on House Bill 2971. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3068, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3068. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3077, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3077. Fourth and final page. And opening the public hearing on House Bill 3172. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3172. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3312. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3312. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3382. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3382. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3392. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3392. Opening the public hearing on House Bill 3399. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3399. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3436. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3436. Opening the public hearing on House Bill 3471. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3471. And House Committee on General Government will now adjourn. Thank you.